Nos acotó Haley. La embajadora de Estados Unidos ante la ONU dejó fuera de su discurso el hecho de que su gobierno viola leyes internacionales todos los días al ocupar territorio sirio y al endorsar la expansión colonial israelí en tierras palestinas. Rafael Cuesta, del colectivo radial Más Voces, nos reporta sobre una acción de autodefensa palestina.
La Autoridad Nacional Palestina interpuso una demanda ante la Corte Penal Internacional para presionar a este ente internacional a que investigue los crímenes de guerra que comete Israel contra los palestinos desde Cisjordania hasta la Franja de Gaza. Nos lo cuenta Aydin Saigan.
Palestina denuncia las atrocidades israelíes ante la Corte Penal Internacional. El responsable de hacerlo ha sido su canciller, Riyad al-Maliki, que se trasladó hasta La Haya, Holanda, donde se reunió con la fiscal del tribunal.
A través de este recurso queremos que la oficina del fiscal abra sin demora una investigación sobre los delitos que concluye actualmente, que han sido comisionados o que están en curso. Creemos que hay pruebas abundantes e insuperables en este sentido y creemos que este proceso, con una investigación, es el curso de acción correcto y necesario.
La denuncia conlleva una larga lista de crímenes, desde la construcción de asentamientos ilegales en los territorios ocupados palestinos hasta los asesinatos cometidos por las fuerzas israelíes en las últimas semanas en la Franja de Gaza.
Palestina tomó esta decisión debido a la intensificación y la gravedad de los crímenes cometidos contra nuestro pueblo, incluida la expansión de asentamientos, la expropiación de tierras y la explotación ilegal de nuestros recursos naturales, así como la brutal y calculada represión de manifestantes pacíficos, particularmente en la Franja de Gaza.
En las últimas 7 semanas, Israel ha asesinado a golpe de bala a más de 100 palestinos durante las marchas de retorno de los gazatíes. Miles más han resultado heridos. El día más sangriento fue este 14 de mayo, con más de medio centenar de muertos en las protestas contra el traslado de la embajada de Estados Unidos a Jerusalén. Son crímenes grabados y vistos por todo el mundo, pero Israel no los acepta y califica la iniciativa palestina de cínica y sin base legal.
El supuesto recurso palestino no tiene validez legal y la Corte Penal Internacional no tiene jurisdicción sobre el asunto palestino-israelí, ya que Israel no es miembro de la Corte y la Autoridad Palestina no es un Estado.
Pero lo cierto es que la CPI, de la que forman parte 123 países, incluida Palestina, es el órgano judicial de la ONU y juzga delitos cometidos contra la legislación internacional. En ese caso, la matanza de civiles palestinos. Crímenes que la ONU también ha acordado investigar enviando una misión a Gaza.
Aydin Saigan.
En tanto, en Estados Unidos, la pobreza y los salarios de hambre que reciben millones de obreros ha llegado a niveles históricos. Telesur viene con los detalles.
Los 50.8 millones de familias que no pueden cubrir los gastos de alojamiento, alimentación, cuidados médicos y transporte constituyen nada más al 43% del total de los hogares de Estados Unidos. Aunque 34.7 millones de familias tienen empleo, 16.1 millones son familias pobres con bienes limitados e ingresos restringidos. Muchos de los individuos calificados de esta manera trabajan en empleos mal remunerados y disponen de escasos ahorros. Además, el informe revela que el 66% de los empleos de Estados Unidos se paga en menos de $20 por hora. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose.
Y aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RT, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre del Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
So, coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, the May 24th, 2018 edition. And I'm thinking we're going to be having A long conversation with Brent, a report from Project Connect, or Project Homeless Connect, whatever it's called these days. It happened yesterday here in Santa Cruz. And possibly a part of or all of an interview with Wes White of Salinas. So that's what you got in store if you want to hang with us, and you'll be able to hear it.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
And here it is Thursday again. So here I am again on a pre-recorded show, but recorded on Thursday, May 24th. So there. About a week ago, Abby Samuels went to court in an obstructing the sidewalk case appeal. She went to trial. She was found guilty, and she appealed the trial to a three-judge panel. She was again found guilty, or that's to say the judge's ruling was upheld, even though I wasn't present at the actual arrest. My understanding from the accounts I heard was it was a bogus arrest. It was part of a politically inspired attack on the Freedom Sleepers, the group concerned with restoring the rights of homeless people in Santa Cruz to sleep and the rights of the public to have access to City Hall as their so-called center of government, the shitty council and all that sort of thing. She declined to move when I guess it was a police officer told her to move because she was taking up only one half of the sidewalk, not blocking it. No one tried to get past. And because of her disobedience to an officer's demand, which was essentially part of their attempt to clear the entire area of both protesters and homeless people, which they successfully did, after a two-year weekly demonstration by the Freedom Sleepers every Tuesday night, demanding an end to the sleeping ban law in Santa Cruz that makes it illegal for anyone, but of course it really only affects homeless people, to sleep after 11 o'clock at night in any public property, in most structures except for homes or hotels, even in private property. And there's some exceptions for backyards, side yards, parking lots, in a very limited way, leaving 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people both without shelter and without even a right to legally lay down their heads outside somewhere. Anyway, Steve Plaich gave an analysis of this trial. I don't think he showed up at the trial. Maybe he did. I'm trying to check out it was a picture of this group, which Abby posted. Unfortunately, she hasn't posted any of her own account. Looking at the picture, I don't see Steve Plaich in the picture. There were 5, 10, 15 people. There were numerous well-wishings from people from different places. Melissa Collins, Chris Kinney, Nicola Tennant, Coral Reef, Judith Gipps, Lucero Luna, one of the original Freedom Sleepers, Marilyn Raposa Bernstein, Miss Daya Wilkes, wishing her well. And I put out the word on the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom email, which you can join if you want by sending me an email at, grab your pencil, I'll tell you again in a moment, rnorris3@hotmail.com, and I'll repeat that in a moment. But unfortunately, Pudna Bombs was not there. I think there's some personal problems between Keith and Abby, largely emphasized by Abby because she did not want Putin Up Bombs as an organization, as far as I could see, at the actual event, which is too bad. I hate to see activists, maintaining a public, declining to come together as a public group because of private difficulties. But it happens, and it happened. I hope it's not going to happen again. And I hope we get a fuller account of what went down from someone who was actually at the trial. I did get a word from Linda LeMaster and Laura Tucker about what happened. It's kind of a rigged game. It's a dangerous situation because we are essentially living in a police state where the police don't have to pay any attention to the actual wording of the rules. The judges are backing them up. I mean, obstructing the sidewalk means actually blocking a way when someone's trying to get through. It doesn't mean theoretically blocking the way for someone who might get through. It has to do with refusing to move when somebody's trying to get through. That's my understanding of it. I think that's a reasonable understanding of it. That was the police department's understanding of it up until the day they decided to change their understanding of it. And again, that was a politically motivated attempt to get rid of protests under the new police chief, Andy Mills. Protests then moved to the encampment that was there, which was not just the Freedom Sleepers, but a week-long, around-the-clock, 24-hour sleep out by the survival sleepers, people who had no place to go after the winter shelter had closed, as is the case again this year here in Santa Cruz. And the protests moved to the town, not the town clock, but the post office, and Andy Mills didn't like that visibility, so he kind of quietly put out the word, that's Police Chief Andy Mills, that the folks could move to San Lorenzo Park, and they did, and then the city actually officially put in porta-potties and provided some garbage, some trash pickup, stuff that I think is something that needed to be extended to encampments all over the city because there's no housing. It's just how it is. There's a huge rent control push going on. They should be doing a rent reduction, but there's not. Right now we're talking about rent control. In any case, I'm looking for, always glad to see when people are taking issues into the public limelight that need to be further exposed. But it's also good if they can get together with other groups that are doing the same thing rather than try to separate themselves from those groups. Although I'm pretty critical of some groups for sure myself. Usually that's because their positions are bad, not because I have personal problems with somebody in the group. Anyway, let's move on. So what I'm going to play now are a series of audio interviews I did with people standing in line and in some cases inside the Portuguese Hall where Project Homeless Connect was held this last year yesterday. And I call it Homeless Connect because it primarily concerned homeless people, even though I know that H word is becoming a no-no, just as the visible presence of the H people is becoming a no-no. And the attempt to pretend that everything is okay, that there's a three-stage shelter program in progress by the city government, which doesn't really have any concrete existence at all other than a campground and a lot of verbiage from Susie O'Hara and Martine Bernal, city manager Mark Bernal and underling Susie O'Hara. So the gentrification erasure of homeless people, or the prettification and the false claims originally pushed by people like former Mayor Mike Rotkin, that Santa Cruz is doing more with their homeless people than anybody else, and are doing a great job, and we can't do more, or millions would come to town. That actually was his phrase at one point. I'm sure he was just being rhetorical. But his attack on homeless civil rights throughout his decades here has not been while he was in power. For which he's never apologized, by the way. When he starts to apologize, I will stop mentioning the past probably as much as I have. So let's listen to some of Project Connect, as they call themselves, or Homeless Connect, as I call it. And then we're going to hear a long discussion by Brent Adams of, is his storage program going to open in June or not? He kind of says it is, but he wants to pretend that he's, He wants to, actually I'm sure he sincerely wants to get the buy-in of his group. Because it, you know, when always it's always great to have the democratic quote-unquote process behind you where you do what your board of directors says and so forth, and that way it's, you can't just blame Brent, you know, because the city likes to tag Brent as a, city government likes to tag Brent as a wild man, you know, can't be dealt with, or at least that's how he sees it. Brent is pretty passionate. He becomes intemperate at times. He's outspoken on occasion, and he, his projects are often centered on his personal leadership a lot. And that can be alienating. He also is very articulate. He also has done a lot of good research. He also is a person who, in spite of himself, speaks the truth often because it blurts out. He's that kind of a guy, and I commend him for that, in spite of himself. And you're going to hear him, too. But first, the actual folks that we're all talking about, people outside in line at Homeless Project Homeless Connect, which is a thing that happens once a year, in case you don't know. I think it's once a year. Maybe it's sometimes twice a year, or maybe it happens in Watsonville and in Santa Cruz at different times. It's a project where they have a building or a big tent. Usually it's a building. I think sometimes it's been in the sports stadium. Sometimes it's been in the Civic Auditorium. Last year, I think it was in a church. Brent mentions. I didn't get to the one last year, I don't think. And this year, it was in a thing called the Portuguese Hall building out in the Harvey West area that was originally, I don't know, it's a meeting place. I've never been there for anything else other than the emergency shelter that happened for everybody after the earthquake in October of 1989, 30 years ago. Anyway, inside this are tables of plenty, clean socks, the little items they give out to homeless people, supposedly places where you can, if you get in there in time, and they're there all day from, 10 o'clock in the morning to, I think, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was there in the morning. You can get DMV services. They used to be, I think there's direction to a, some court assistance to get rid of the innumerable tickets that people get for simply being alive and homeless in the Santa Cruz area, either at night and often during the day. I think they even have a bathroom there, unlike the Loudoun Nelson Center, which has closed its bathrooms to poor and homeless people, as have other places. Although the visitor's bathroom is still open in the Bookshop Coonerty, also known as the Bookshop Santa Cruz, which may not let people they don't like in, but generally, both because they're being paid by the city government and also because for years the Coonerty family, to their credit, has kept open their bathroom privately, that is, say, a privately owned bathroom which was open to the community, except you if you crossed the Coonerty family when they had their gentrification agenda and decided to fall in line with the neoliberal pretty up the town and drive out the poor agenda, masquerading as a bad behavior in stop bad behavior downtown under that cover. Anyway, here's some interviews in line and some commentary from me.
Portuguese Hall, it's the 23rd of May, about 10:05, a lot of cars in the back parking lot, some pavilions outside under an overcast sky, tables with chairs, sort of the standard setup that they used to have at the Civic Auditorium each year for the project Homeless Connect. So, items for people to pick up, Styrofoam Santas and other giveaways. There's the animal shelter has a booth, and there are folks in line waiting for something.
I'm on the street.
We're talking with
Kevin Mason.
And you're outside yourself?
Yes, sir.
How long?
Since I've been. For a while.
Last 10 years?
A couple years.
How's it been in the last few months here in Santa Cruz?
I'm really thankful. It didn't happen that good, though. I actually, they sent me I got cold. I got super cold. And my heart went out. I almost died via it. And they let me, they had me leave right then that day that was cold.
They being?
At a place where they had let me stay there, you know, the night.
Campground or an indoor indoor place?
Staying there at the street there. And I almost died from it.
You're talking about the homeless service center? Are you talking about the River Street
right
campground?
There, the first day there.
Coral Street? Or
I don't know. See, some of the places I don't talk that good. I'm all talked up.
That's all right.
My heart went down. See right here, my heart, because this guy's almost...
You're showing me your scars.
Yeah, gotcha.
And,
what kind of treatment did you get?
A few things. It took a while to get me through the dogs, the drugs, or not drugs, to the people to keep me alive. That thing.
And here you are.
I've gotten sucky. It took a long time. It took like four doctors to get me alive.
How old are you?
47.
And so,
but it's all because of those guys. Pretty much, they had me take off, and everything was all wet and weight. You know, they told me to leave weight, and I got weight because of it. And I just nothing, just went bad.
And who were those guys who told you that?
The place from the places where they have some things that can't talk that good, unfortunately.
Was it a campground or was it? Or was it a building?
A place right there by the... I don't know the people they are. Not the dog.
Was it a campground area?
Yeah, right there.
Was it on...
They let me stay there legally and everything. They let me stay the night.
How long?
And they just said that it was too wet right there, and they had to leave me right then and there. They didn't
were
even...
Were you in your...
I was there already.
Were you in your own tent?
Yeah, I was in my own place and everything, and they said, oh, this is pretty dangerous right here. Too wet.
Were there other tents there?
Yeah, there were people there. And they just said that they let me out, you know, and it basically almost killed me.
And were the tents next to each other?
Yeah, it was next to each other. Everybody was next door, you know. And they said it was too dangerous right there or whatever. They didn't they didn't help me get my place around. They didn't let me say, hey, you know, can we help you cross or anything like this. I was all wet and freezing.
How long ago was this?
It almost killed me. The truth.
I got you. How long ago was this, man?
I've been through all this.
Was this recently? A couple weeks?
Yeah,
days?
Yeah.
A couple months?
Yeah, 2 months. Yeah, about that.
Yeah. Well, but I lived through it. So.
Here you are. Yes. And again, we've been talking with
Kevin Mason. But yeah,
hey, Kevin.
Thankful. You know, it taught me a lot, I guess. But I just hope that they treat people better than that, you know, because, you know, they should have just treat things better. These people that can't use the bathrooms and stuff like that, you know, is what makes me more than anything. All the little small, stupidest things like that, you can't even use the bathroom.
Dig
it. And it just shows, you know, what they do to people, you know, and I hope that they'll treat people better, you know. I'm able to talk a little bit better now, but sometimes I can't even talk now, and I have to do all kinds of stuff.
You're getting some of your message out here.
I'm thankful to meet people like you guys and you know.
I'm not doing shit, but I'm doing interviews.
Talking, you know, thank you, sir, but yeah, it's Kevin.
Well, thank you, Kevin.
Okay, yeah, nice to meet you.
It's Courtney.
And Courtney, you're outside?
Yes.
How long?
I've been out here about 20 minutes.
And how long have you been out? I mean, are you sleeping outside?
Oh, I actually am lucky enough to, my brother got a place, and so I'm able to stay with him.
As long as your relationship remains good with your brother.
Yeah. And, yes.
Were you outside before that?
I was.
For how long?
About 3 months.
Here in Santa Cruz?
Yeah.
And where were you? What was the situation for you?
I would sleep wherever I could, in my car, on friends' couches, on strangers' couches, you know, whatever works.
And any hassles from police for ever sleeping in your car?
Always. Yeah. Always.
How many times would you say you were contacted by them?
At least every other night.
And what did they tell you?
That I have to move my vehicle, that I can't sleep in my vehicle, that I can't sleep here in my vehicle.
Were you alone or were you with someone?
No, I was by myself.
And What was your response to this?
I don't have anywhere else to go.
Did you move, or did you just say, I'm sorry, I got to stay here and sleep? Or what was your reaction?
I asked if I could sleep there because it's the safest bet for me, but it wasn't. Sometimes they were nice and sometimes they weren't.
Did you get any tickets?
Yes.
How many would you say you got?
At least 10 over the last year.
And what general spots were you in? Was it any one place or one area you were ticketed?
Anywhere I went, it seemed.
And so we're talking mainly police or deputies?
I'm not sure.
Deputies are blue. Deputies are brown. Police are blue.
Oh, okay. Okay, so then it was definitely a mix. Yeah, it was definitely a mix of people.
Did any of these tickets go to warrant? Did you get any hassles for that?
Yes, I did, because I couldn't afford to pay them because I'm homeless.
What did you do?
Are
they still sitting around waiting to get you? Should I call the police now?
Yeah,
they might have some way to deal with this here, supposedly.
I'm praying that they do.
And we've been talking with, if you wish to say,
hey, Courtney.
Thank you.
You should be on free radio Thursday evening or Sunday morning. Here's the card with some of the times. If you want to find out more details, call me.
Thank you. I totally will.
All this underbuilt land they got here, you figured they can actually open something up for people to park the cars and sit back, you know, without getting harassed by the police.
You've suffered that yourself recently?
Oh, yeah. We live in our van.
And you two are together?
Yeah, husband and wife for 22 years.
And have you been sleeping outside or in a vehicle?
In the vehicle.
And how have the police treated you in the van?
Rough. I mean, they harass you all the time.
In the last 3 months?
In the last 3 months. They just got in marking the road we stay on now.
And are you inside the city limits or outside?
Inside.
And what's been the typical experience you have with the cops?
Oh, they constantly knock on your door, window, tell you you got to move, no camping. I mean, you can go up to Safeway right now and park your van. As soon as they say it's a van, they'll walk up, knock on the window, say no camping. Even though you're getting out to go inside the store.
It's ridiculous.
I mean,
it's stupid.
As soon as they say it's a van or a camper, they're right there. You can't camp here.
Have you gotten any tickets?
Oh,
yes.
So if anyone who's listening to this broadcast has experienced something the same or has friends that experienced the same, please give a call to the Huff Line, that's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-4833, and let us know what's going on. I'm always encouraging people in their vehicles to try to form an organization together, kind of a union, support group, at least to share each other's experiences. There are people who do live in their vans who do that. We used to have kind of, I wouldn't say informal meetings, but I was at least in contact with those people. At the Red Church, which will, I guess, be resuming meals, I hope, in early June, at the same time as I'm hoping that Brent Adams will begin his storage program so that people can store their stuff during the day, at least some people. There's a huge population, and it's not going to serve everybody, obviously, but it could be a beginning. So let's get back to Project Connect. But more important to you out there, Connect happens once a year, as you'll hear me say probably repeatedly in this tape. I said it when I was there. I don't know if I said it on tape. But it's what happens the rest of the year that really tells the tale. So. How many in the last, what do you say?
At least 15.
And what's your response to these tickets? How do you deal with them? Do you, you know?
We try to get them paid off, and that way we don't get harassed, you know, get, you know, targeted.
Do you recall what the charge is per ticket?
All it is it says no camping.
Right. But how much do they charge you for?
It's like
187.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's better than 198. That's
yeah.
How much it was. You want to say who you are for free radio? You don't have to.
I'm Roger Lick.
I'm Renetta Lick.
And here you are at Project Connect.
Yeah.
What do you think of this? I see you've got medical, dental, mental, behavioral, vision, veteran services, smart path, DMV, pet care, massage, and yoga. This is for the free radio audience. Bike maintenance, aromatherapy, haircuts, housing benefits, cell phones, family resources, quality of life services, free meal, and photos. I hope you got all that, folks. Have you used these services before?
Yeah, we went to one before because we have a cat. And that's how our cat got neutered. Got the chip put in the back of his neck. got all the shots and everything. And
it's a great project.
Oh, yeah. They do wonders for everybody.
For one day out of 365.
Yeah.
Right, well, I'll let you get to the intake here. And again, we've been talking with?
Uh-huh.
Your name again?
Roger Lick.
And Renetta Lick.
Hey. From what I see, it's very saddening.
Okay. What's your name?
Maggie.
Maggie, are you outside?
I am.
For how long?
Only a couple weeks.
And how have you been treated by police, if you wish to say?
I've only had encountered them once.
What did they do? They gave you hot coffee and cocoa and some marshmallows?
They didn't really treat me very well at all. They were very degrading. And in their conversation, they acted as if I did something wrong when I know I was doing nothing wrong.
Were you sleeping at night?
No, I was on the beach in the middle of the day enjoying the beach.
Yeah, but did you look homeless?
I did. I had a big pack, and so that was the problem.
Packing
so.
Is a crime in Santa Cruz.
I said, are you camping? I said, no, I'm not camping. I'm enjoying the beach today. Wide awake, 10 o'clock.
To which they said,
we're going to have a conversation about this if I get a call. And I said, well, let's have it now. I don't believe you received any calls. No, we haven't received any calls, but if we do, we'll talk.
Say fuck off and die, nothing like that.
No, of course
certainly not.
I respect the authority. They do have a job to do out there.
Not on you, hopefully.
But I wasn't doing anything wrong. So it's just an appearance thing.
Well, if you are homeless, that is wrong.
It seems that we can't exist between 12 p.m. and 5 a.m. We have to be invisible. And it's a task, especially for those that don't like to break the rules. So hopefully they'll find a better way for us.
Hey, and we've been talking
with Maggie.
Thanks, Maggie.
Thank you.
All right. I just want to say, you know, hopefully we get a home soon for me and my family.
Right.
You know, that's what we're here for housing. Hopefully we get something coming up soon.
And your name is?
Jose.
Thank you, Jose. Thank you. We're talking with... If you wish to say.
Work, no housing.
And if any more details, have you been looking for work yourself? Or?
Lots of work, just no housing.
And so what do you do at night with no housing, man?
Fuck.
You sleep illegally? Is that what you're doing?
No, I sleep in the bush. Not illegally, legally in the bush.
Now, so you haven't been hassled by police for this recently?
The cops, man, they don't care. They're just getting their paycheck.
Right. I'm not trying to, you know, say that they're bad people, but I'm just wondering,
They're bad.
Are they bad?
Are police officers? They're doing the work of the rich and greedy is what they're doing.
Are you accusing them of being class warriors and old slave catchers?
Yeah, pretty much.
How long have you been living this fitful existence?
42 years.
And have you ever had housing here in Santa Cruz?
Yeah.
How long ago?
Let me see. It's been a while.
And has anything improved under the new police chief, Andy Mills?
I doubt it.
So you haven't noticed any change in police attitudes?
No, it's worse, if anything.
What about those wonderful Parks and Rec Rangers? How have they been treating you?
I haven't seen them. Well, Thank God.
That might be good. What about the First Alarm Security?
First Alarm Security, I haven't seen them either. So
deputies?
Keep our fingers crossed. And
FBI?
I don't know. I don't think
you
so.
Better watch your steps, sir. That's all I can say.
It's the rich and greedy. That's the only ones you really got to worry about.
Any other thoughts you want to pass on?
Just lots of work, no housing.
What's a typical thing you do for work?
Labor work.
Such as?
Like a Mexican. Like an illegal alien.
So the last job you had did what, for instance?
Just working for local family-owned, you know, businesses in the Santa Cruz area.
What kind of wages do they give you?
Minimum wage.
And what kind of, is there a place to take a piss? You get lunch, that sort of thing?
Yeah, the work's fine. It's just no housing.
As you said in the beginning.
Lots of work, no housing.
And if you wish to say, we've been talking with, first name only. Thank you. Since we missed most of that because I have my machine on the wrong setting, we've been talking with Travis, who says he's been around here for, 18 years, did you say?
Oh, yes.
And it's gotten somewhat worse in the last few months. You've been in the downtown area. Any tickets?
Just a few trespassing here and there, but those were from 4 to 6 months ago. I'm still going back to trial for those in 1 month.
My sympathies. And we've been talking with
Travis W.
Thanks, Travis.
They need to build more better houses here in Santa Cruz, and they need to be more lenient to people who are trying to strive and become something like a butterfly.
What's the name of your pooch? I see you carrying your, you got your backpack, a pooch, you're carrying, looks like you're bedding with you.
My pooch's name is Karma. She's only 3 years old. She's a Weimaraner and blue nose mix.
And is there a place you can store your stuff during the day, or you kind of have to carry it with you?
Well, most days we have to carry our stuff all the time because we don't want it to be stolen or taken from the Rangers.
Okay. And we've been talking with, if you wish to
see. Devin Pierce.
Thanks, Devin.
Streets team. The downtown Streets team.
All right. I think we talked before, right?
Yes.
Thanks, Devin.
Yep.
Any reports?
No.
Street reports of any kind for free radio?
Free radio? I'm about to be homeless again because my landlord keeps failing my Section 8 inspections and it's so hard to find housing. I've been looking for a year and a half. I have excellent credit, 29 years of excellent rental references, and I still can't find a place.
So, and we've been talking with, if you wish to say.
Susan.
Thanks, Susan.
Bless your heart.
Any street reports?
As far as, no.
Okay. How's Hot Project Connect treating you?
It's doing well.
Are you a regular volunteer every year, or is this your first time?
No, my first time volunteering.
And, I can't really ask you much at the moment, can I?
No, I guess not.
How did you hear about this?
I'm a resident at Santa Cruz Residential Recovery.
How you doing, buddy? And that's for drug recovery?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Yourself a recovering drug user? Or?
Yes.
How long ago were you a user, if you wish to say?
Until I entered rehab.
And how long ago was that?
3 weeks.
So you're on top of it still.
Yeah, coming on up.
All right. You have a place to live.
Not afterwards.
So what's your plan, if you have any?
Hopefully it'll be I can get a job and get into a sober living environment. It's about the only thing affordable.
How long were you outside previous?
About 8 months.
What do you use in Firefish?
I'd ask you more, but we're at the front of the line.
All right.
Been talking with you. Want to say your first name? You can.
Daniel.
Thanks, Daniel.
And now for a little comic relief. Here's an older one from Randy Rainbow about North Korea and Fuhrer Trump.
Every other internet.
He always takes to Twitter just to grumble, grouse, and gripe. He's having fun, but Kim Jong-un is not the playful type. I'm slightly more than panicked that this schmuck is gonna wipe us off the map by acting like a baby. He's playing cat and mouse, but he's the mouse among these men. He fires up his fan base with his talks at the UN. I'd rather he behave more presidential, but again, he's acting like a tiny little baby. And though I know his followers are thrilled, he's gonna get us killed. How do you solve a problem like Korea? How do you sleep when missiles start to fly? How do you not have constant diarrhea when all of our lives depend upon this guy? Many a name you know you'd like to call her, but certain things are better left unsaid. 'Cause how can you do the trick with childish rhetoric? How can two tiny men have such big heads? How do you solve a problem like Korea when you're a crazy dotard?
Dotard.
Dotard. Or a dotard, I'm sorry.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself. The United States is ready, willing, and able. But hopefully,
it's gonna be a long, long time. So touchdown finally brings him back to fight. He's not the man they think he is at home. Oh no, no, no.
Rocket Man.
He's a rocket man. Rocket man.
Rocket man.
Burning on
Jong-un saying he takes President Trump's threats personally, so he has been rattled.
Think it's gonna be a long, long time till this dude finally does something right. You think his tiny brain would finally grow? Oh, no, no, no.
Dotard.
Dotard.
He's a rocket man. Rocket man. This bone.
They will be met
with fire and fury,
the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Oh, Jesus.
How do you solve a problem like Korea? How do you get them not to drop a bomb? How do you calm their autocratic leader?
Just tell him his hair looks dumb and go, your mom. Trust me, that shit always works.
Why does your mouth have constant diarrhea when you're supposed to be a diplomat?
Your imbecilic insults could have apocalyptic results. Just tweet him and say, hey, Kim, your ass is fat. Don't.
Oh, how do you solve a problem like Korea?
And by the way, Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. Little Rocket Man.
Girl.
Not like that.
Rocket Man.
Dotard.
And next up is one of our standards, a conversation with Warming Center activist Brent Adams. Here we go. That was, by the way, Randy Rainbow's How Do You Solve a Problem Like Korea, which seems to be pretty contemporary considering the bullshit being slung back and forth between the two Führers these days. Not that Obama, Bush, and Clinton were that much better. There's been a state of essentially cold war between the Koreas for, 70 years, thanks to the U.S. intervention there under Truman, and the declining to actually resolve the issue there. Focusing on Trump and the Republicans rather than on the policy generally is a big mistake, and I encourage folks to keep focusing on what's really happening, not what Democrats and Republicans use as part of their campaign blurbs. Okay, well, I'm on the line with activist Brent Adams of the Warming Center and hopefully the Storage Project coming around the pike. Brent has been advised by his board that he has to be rein in his tongue, so to speak. There is a website people may know of called Santa Mierda, which is sort of rampantly pretty, I think it's pretty anti-homeless. Others might differently describe it. Which, you know, Brent responds to. Brent has been kind of free and open in his responses to some extent. And he's been directed to no longer give unchecked conversations based on my questions. So I've asked him to comment on a couple things, which I'm hoping he will. And, you know, you can always say no comment, Brent, if you want. But go ahead. Hi, Brent. That's my intro there.
Hi, thanks for that. Yeah, sorry for that. I know that's disparity between being a community member and saying what we want to say and then being responsible for more than just our individual selves, which I'm becoming more responsible for things like the efficacy, the ability to work with the city or not. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good. Yeah, so, but we chose some things, one being the fact, and it was my call, I asked them to help me find some boundaries. And then have a conversation with me rather than them censoring me. I listed everything up. I showed them a bunch of stuff that I got online and some of the comments. I told them some of the stories about how I wrecked things with my mouth. And we chose a few things. Space is really where I just kind of shoot from the hip. And then we talked about just limiting those spaces. And then some of the other hats that I wear that can be confounding, try to be a little more act without bias. So that's where I'm at now.
Well, I think your experience is not really bias, but simply the voice of your opinions based on your experience. A bias, I think, would be maybe it's not prejudice, maybe it's bias. That's different. But, I think I think I and I'll say this, and you don't have to respond to this if you don't want to, which is I think that it doesn't really matter how nice you are to these people. What matters is their agenda, what they want to do. And that, of course, has always been a difference of opinion between us. But I think the power you amass, which has to do with your connections with the people that you were meeting with last week and you've been working with for the last few years on Sanctuary Village and the other groups, is really what they're listening to and looking at rather than, you know, whatever comments you make. But, in other words, I would urge you not to judge yourself too harshly.
Thank you. I've sabotaged things unintentionally a few different times. And when I'm critical of the encampment and the three-phase plan in public, city council members come and go, but Tina Scholl really remembers, and to the city of O'Hara, and those are people that I'm going to play in the sandbox with for many years, and so I don't know what. So I just have to be mindful. That's all.
Until we can throw them out, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, Tina Scholl has been responsible for the destruction of the Measure K Commission, and Susie O'Hara, of course, spearheaded the bullshit around the task force for public safety, which is bullshit. And I don't expect you to say anything if you want to make good relations with those people. But for me, and I think to some extent for you too, the truth comes first. You know. And anyway, go ahead with what you want to say.
No, I said enough. I think the question is when and where can we say what we need to say? I'm just learning about the priority of to take on a role like the directorship of a nonprofit that's doing renegade behavior, but its main purpose is to help people. Then I have to make sure that when I'm speaking my mind about different things that the city is doing, always to remember that those two things, like the long, for me, it's not about my freedom of speech right now. It's about how can I most effectively help the people I want to help. Also, I want to bring people in, like you say, a mass power or whatever, which is true. It's mainly about building community around the work that we want to do. And I can build better, stronger community if I'm seen as less terse, less attacking, less angry, because that has been alienating. I'm an alienating type person, but I do want to build some community, diverse community around some of the work we're doing, because that's the way it's really going to fly. And so just kind of changing up my style a little bit. The question is where, you know, what we see things that are happening within the city government, we really think that the power is unchecked and they're doing lots of damage in our view. How do we address that, especially if we don't see anybody calling them out on it? And that's, I think, that where you and I stand a lot of the time. There's nobody actually doing that quote-unquote truth to power, like you stand in front of them. But on the other hand, Robert, you don't really I think that is the beauty of you, and I wish I had, you know, I wish we could always say what we want to say without having negative ramifications. But it's true that they're pointing to the fact that I said something, you know, earlier in the year, last year, as reason for the warming center not to get funded by the city. Now folding back, I think we might be grateful that we're not getting city funding, because that would have seriously limited. It's funny, I have to be really careful again because I'm starting to talk here, but there's an organization that I work with that I've been critical of, and over the last year they've chosen to give us small sums of money to do little work for them, and I can see how that actually has me playing nicer, even though I still, you know, would want to be critical. They give, you know, they'll give us $1,000 to share outreach with them. They'll give us $1,000 to do a resource list for their website, things like that. It almost seems like, I like that. I like that. Give me money. I'll be nicer to you.
Yeah, the danger is...
Literally, that's what they do out there in the world.
You know what the danger is, though. The danger is that the experiences that you've had traveling up and down the coast, the
the research you've done, which is perhaps more extensive than almost anyone in this community around homeless encampments, at least that I've been in touch with recently, is going to have to be set aside because you want to, you know, because you feel a need to, or you're afraid of pandering to the prejudices and the fears and the mistakes and the fuck-ups of people in power, which I think, you know, it's possible to continue to point these out, maybe by, as you know, you can always appoint someone else director, or, you know, the board of directors can appoint someone else director of these projects, and you can be an independent voice who's a supportive voice, but, you know, but somebody else plays the lick-the-ass role, if you forgive me for putting it that way. The role, so that the whole project doesn't get co-opted. That's the concern that I think, you know, I would have.
I'm living a bit of a nightmare because we did, you know, my story is working on Sanctuary Camp after some research, having it not gain footing, getting some resistance from the Take Back crowd, a little bit of, really it was the Stab Santa Cruz blog that did Sanctuary Camp in, and then going to the Warming Center and being successful there, and then doing more research on the camp concept, learning how they're effective and how they how the cities take more of a role, and then wanting, you know, to bring it forth ever more, like having the coalition and doubling down on the concept that we think that city certified, county certified transitional encampments where they don't have to actually design them or pay for them or run them. It's a up to the design of the thing that you structure, getting that on the books and letting a nonprofit do all the heavy lifting like they do elsewhere. And then watching the city do something completely different, very audaciously, kind of doing their own thing, and having me not be in the room, having some of the vision and the expertise be side, you know, just ignored. And so I'm already in that space. It has a lot to do with they're not just wanting to play with me at all and our nonprofit. So if I were to take their story, I've done a lot of damage to my ability to do beautiful things in this community, and they're making me the reason for it, and that really hurts.
But
I don't believe that story. I think that's an excuse. It's the straw man tactic where they're still using it. They're still pointing at me, even though I can't really say why I think they're doing it, because that's, again, we're getting in that area where I shouldn't be commenting. But what's true for the long-term longevity of the project is we're doing the stories program because integrity demands, like, what's happening right in front of us. Should I stay, you know, away for 5 months editing a documentary that's going to be, I think, impactful, or should I work on the difficult stuff that we see right in front of us right now? And that's the integrity challenge. So if we can get the storage program up and running and funded, then I might have some time luxury to spend a lot of the summer editing this documentary. It's still, the project still is going on, but as time marches on, the story changes quite a bit. Navigation centers are now proliferating around the state, that San Francisco model. Santa Cruz has done its own version of a camp. So that's actually an intriguing part of the story. That's just kind of unfolding on its own.
Can you distinguish, well, actually, before I ask you the question, I'm asking you to distinguish between the Navigation Center of San Francisco or San Diego-wise from your own sense of, you know, what really needs to be done in terms of the sanctuary village or small encampments. But what I want to say is that I would encourage you to remember that, well, it's tempting to look upon the government and maybe a few nonprofits with, deep pockets, you know, or big philanthropists as being, you know, the people you have to pay attention to, the people you have to not offend, the people you have to worry about. Remember that the community as a whole has far more power once you can mobilize it than any of these fucking groups that, you know, have essentially usurped the power, whether it's the 1% or the government or the, you know, long-time established institutions or big banks, you know, whatever you got. They're very powerful. But, you know, They're not as powerful as the community. And that's what they're afraid of. You see, that's what they pay attention to. That's when they'll suddenly start treating you, invite you to a seat on the board, try to co-opt you, because you have that group behind you. And the challenge, I think, is to get that group behind you. I know you've been trying to do that through adopting a different strategy than, let's say, the protest strategy that a lot of the rest of us, and yourself included, have tried to do. Also, I'd remind you that if you may tend to be too harsh on yourself because you're trying to put too big a burden on yourself, because, you know, mainly because you want to maintain control of the situation because you have faith in your own vision, which I appreciate. But remember, there are others also who've been working with you who could pick up the reins on this, maybe not to the extent you could, maybe, you know, but they could still do it. And you can also, you could also approach it that way. And you yourself have called for this self-criticism, or the criticism by the group. I assume nobody came to you and said, oh, damn it, Brent, you fucked up. We want to change things. That wasn't what happened. You yourself anxiously feared that, you know, you weren't doing the best you could, that you sabotaged this and that. I think you blame yourself. I'm not trying to be nice to you, Brent. I'm not a nice guy in that regard. I don't think you did that. I think that the city, for its own reasons that you don't want to discuss, and, you know, I can talk about that, is, you know, they made their own decisions and will continue to do that until the power — that's why I'm a big fan of activism, but, you know, there are other roads into that too — until the power is amassed against them, where they suddenly change and they're leading the parade. Oh yeah, Brent's a great guy, blah, 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 you know. But that's not going to matter either. What matters is that the job gets done. And that, I think, is your concern now, and probably to some extent mine as well. So go ahead.
Yeah, who cares about the great guys? We see some people, one of them we've mentioned, others we have not yet. Using the populist device to run for city council and things like that. And we don't want to see that. To my mind, that's not true leadership. True leadership is, doing real work, being effective, and doing a good job of creating community around the work that we're doing. I look at the protest model a lot, outside of Santa Cruz and inside of Santa Cruz. We've had four different opinions about where we can go with it today and tomorrow. And I'm disheartened that Santa Cruz has shifted, or maybe the United States, or maybe humanity has shifted. And you have to — I think it could be the internet. It could be the devices that we hold. It takes a different message, a different vision. I'm not sure how to do it. I'm watching the populist behaviors of some people who are running for city council, and I don't like the watered down, the full on feel good approach. There's a lot of programs that, you know, what is power? We see Take Back Santa Cruz. We see the support of things like the Clean Team, now Downtown Streets Team, and the general support of what the city's doing with its three-phase plan, and watching members of Take Back Santa Cruz kind of fall in and support it, and it's fascinating to watch. But when you have power structures like the city, and all around the state, we watched, like you mentioned, San Diego, San Francisco, now we're watching Berkeley create its own, and other cities talk using the word, like Santa Cruz is uttering the word navigation center, and then talking about, you know, more than $1 million a year invested in such things. It'll be much more than $1 million when they find the location. Right now they're talking $1 million plus just to go towards phase two, where the current plan already is at $1 million a year with the encampment at $2,000 per tent. So the city, I guess, is the home team. That's like what people like to play to. If they're doing big things and it's pretending to solve big problems, then people really like that. I think it's important for me to really go, you know, what you and I do, we're pretty close to the street. We see where the needs are. I want to go straight to the heart of these things and be a little more authentic with my time and energy. The people on the street keep you real. It's hard to, you know, they got it. They know what's up. We had Project Connect yesterday, where there literally were dozens upon dozens upon dozens of tables with pamphlets and almost nothing tangible being offered to people who are so desperate, going, you know, collecting all of the pamphlets. Imagine being a person who sleeps outside, desperate for shelter or even a clean pair of underwear, and to just have a bag full of pamphlets. You know, but a lot of them had tooth removed and haircuts, and there are other things that were offered yesterday. But we were wanting to say there's a storage program. Here's a phone number. We're going to open it in a week and a half. Find out where it is. We're not going to make an announcement about it just yet. And that really resonated with a lot of people. I think that helps keep us honest. Warming Center a little bit more, but I mean a little bit less because it's just not open very often. But.
Did it resonate, by the way, with? Did you talk to any of the other pamphleteers at the other tablers? Did they actually show some interest in that opening of the storage program as well?
It's a weird. Again, I got to be careful. But it's a weird space. You've been in them, I think. It's a lot of them keep to themselves. A lot of them, I think, they know they're just doing time at their booth. They don't have a lot to offer, but their organization needs to be there. They feel the people who are circulating really really dig it. We're always trying to figure out how to work together. It's weird how many of these mega nonprofits find no way to work together whatsoever. But the ones who do, like the library, Miley. Of the library, Association of Faith Communities to a certain extent, and others. You know, we obviously have overlaps, but I think it's it's mainly a lot of the community members that come out that come to see. That's fascinating. Also, people who don't live outside, but they come anyway to kind of cruise the Project Connect scene, and that's really the ones that I find. I think they might be supporting one nonprofit or another when they're there, but they come and they kind of do a lot of cross-pollination. And that's how we've, you know, and then we got a lot of people's names on the volunteer list. It's weird to have a volunteer list at the Project Connect because it's mostly people who need services, but you'd be surprised how many people come out of the woodwork who are housed. And because we don't view the people that we want to serve as volunteers. We have a class distinction that we do not like. We're addressing it eventually, whereas it's the sanctuary type cap and other programs that give people volunteer. We're going to be hiring. We will be hiring from the population that we serve, though. I think that's important to note.
Was a little bit hard to hear you now. Are you in a good location for speaking? I'm not sure, but... you were fuzzing out there a bit, but
I'm embedded in an RV in the downtown core.
It's getting better. I think you shifted your position in bed there. That's good.
Yeah.
You've been to past Project Connects or Project Homeless Connects. Been doing it for about, they've been doing it 5 or 6 years. I don't know. And you presumably there looked like a lot of. I often find there are a lot of volunteers there who seem bright eyed and bushy tailed. Some of them, as you say, merely sort of there because their organizations assigned them to do that. But some because they really want to help, whether it's for a day or a week or something. Did you find any difference between this year and previous years in terms of folks who you felt would be interested in, particularly in the projects you're working on?
I have to be careful here. I don't want to say anything negative about the Project Connect or people in general. The types of people who come out to volunteer, they do have like a bit, you know, big round eyes, and it's adorable. At the same time, they are not. If you're going to fall into programs like ours, you might have surveyed the field a little bit and have tried some other stuff, and. Or, you know, you go, wow, what's really, to find value in the work that we do, I think, we're a little gritty, street, and, we have less polish, but it's more, like you say, it's vision oriented, and it's doing a lot with little. It takes a sophisticated person to really get that, the wow factor, rather than the shiny, mega nonprofit, that has lots of space, you know, the mega nonprofits bring volunteers and interns in by the hundreds, but they just go through them because there's not much for them to do. We're seeing that with interns too. Interns are Very highly dispensable. Expendable. They burn out quick. They have other things that they're doing that are much more important to them, which is their coursework. And I see that an intern will show up once and realizing they now can put it on their resume. The volunteers that are moving through, it looks like their first foray into volunteerism at all, and so they really don't know how to view us. They are taking, it's fascinating, they're actually guiding somebody who's a person who sleeps outside, and they're guiding them through the process, and they are as confused as anyone, because there's just not much to offer. The person will say, I need shelter, I need clothing, I need like whatever, and they're going through the Project Connect, passing dozens of pamphlet-oriented tables, and I can see it must be difficult.
Well, what have, has there been a change? My question was, over the last few years, have you seen any difference, either a positive, negative? And unfortunately, I do have to ask you, you can always say no comment, if it's getting better, worse, or a mixture of the two, you know.
I don't know. I think Project Connect is becoming, organization, what do they call it, Applied Survey Research, they're the group that does it. They're the HUD, they do the point in time count, and now they're doing the point in time count in dozens of cities. They're based here. They're doing that, the PID count in dozens of cities, and they're doing Project Connects in dozens of cities now, too. They started it in Santa Cruz, and they're all over the place. But when you look at the effectiveness of the one in Santa Cruz, it's really gone. It's small. Last year it was at Santa Cruz Bible. That was strange out on Frederick because it's so far away from the population. This one was at the Portuguese Hall, and it really felt like they've lost their budget or something. They've diminished their budget. But I don't know what to say about that. Everybody, budget difficult. This is a weird project. It doesn't produce funding. They might get grants for it. It was very well populated.
What about the number of people who you feel would be sympathetic to the projects you've been working on, the storage project, the old sanctuary village project, and so forth? Has there been a change over the last few years? And this particular one, yesterday, I guess it was?
Yeah,
yesterday. Talk a bit about that if you can.
Warming Center is always weird because it's a pop-up and we don't have anything to offer. We've always been offering the 211 information card or the one with our phone number on it and giving blankets away. It's always in the spring or summer, and it's not when the winter happens, so it just doesn't make any sense. All we've been trying to do historically is get our name into people's heads. Like, call the number. When you're cold, call the number. It's going to happen in the future, the distant future, but we'll see us in the future. So that was always really weird.
But did you get more people, though, to do that this year than last year from the people coming through? By that, I don't mean homeless people necessarily, but the people who were at that Project Homeless Connect, which, I mean, I think at one point the volunteers a year or two ago outnumbered the homeless people who came. Kind of weird. But in other words, of the volunteers, are you getting a more interested and sympathetic and effective response than you were from past Project Homeless Connects?
What we do is we try to get as robust a volunteer email list as possible. Then we put the word out, and then we see who shows up. And you never know who's going to show up, but we always have enough. The real job is just to always get names on the email list at any of these events, enter them into the database finally, and then so when we do activate the warming center, 9 months from now or whenever it's going to be, that we do have people showing up and people, so just keeping that going. That's actually something that we're always trying to remember to do.
And how did that go in terms comparatively over the last few years and at this particular event yesterday?
Pretty good, because we weren't really talking about the warming center hardly at all. What we were doing this year is different. Now we have a lot of street credit, meaning
We've done so much work. We've seen so many of the people who sleep on the street in Santa Cruz that almost everybody knows us. And then we've given so many blankets out. We spent so much time in San Lorenzo Park that people really know who I am as a face and warming center, and they know they can call us. So when they come by, there's a lot of family feeling, like, hey, bro, how's it going? You know, and I'm asking a lot of personal questions. How are you doing? How's that thing? How's the leg? But really what we're doing is I handed out 200 little pieces of paper that say, storage program, launch coming soon, call, you know, and the hotline number and big, you know, call to find out when and where. And so we got a lot of response in that regard. Almost everybody saw value, and I just say, you know, we're going to have a storage program 2 hours in the morning and the evening. Keep your stuff safe. We don't have to carry our stuff around anymore. I always, you know, say we instead of you.
Again, you're focusing, and I think it's telling that you are, because I think it shows what your real focus is on the people in need. But I was asking you about the volunteers.
Yeah, yeah.
And whether you think you're getting more than you were, and whether that email list, what actually happened last year in terms of how many folks that you took down on the list actually later contributed to what you were doing. How is that increasing, decreasing?
I have no idea.
Okay.
The volunteer list either does or doesn't fill up. I'll do tabling downtown. I'll do this, that, and the other. Always I'll try to have a volunteer list, have a meeting, have a volunteer list. I don't know. It works, but I don't have any quantifying.
That's fine. That's fine. But back to Brent in a moment. Here's a little Phil Oakes to take a break.
Cowboys, he rides El Pony. He fights the bad boys, brings them to their knees. He patrols the highways from the air. He keeps the country safe from long hair. I am the masculine American man.
That was Phil Oakes from his Rehearsals for Retirement, I Kill, Therefore I Am.
Quick update, Andy Mills, who I recently sent some correspondence to, responded with unaccustomed quickness. I asked him, he still hasn't responded to my request for more specifics about rape kit closures that I'm still waiting for information on regarding the Santa Cruz Police Department numbers sent off, when they were sent off to the DOJ for analysis, how many have come back, how long they had to sit in the police department before that happened, what the backlog is, if any. But what I did ask him for also was the use of force policy for shooting at vehicles, for suspects fleeing in vehicles. There hasn't been any indication that that's been happening in Santa Cruz, but there was a story in either today or yesterday's Chronicle about that issue coming up in San Francisco. So I wanted to find out what the Santa Cruz Police Department's position was. I wrote him yesterday, I believe, and he, Andy Mills, the police chief, wrote back. He actually sent me, I asked him for the specific policy. Instead, he sent me 480-odd pages of police manual. I requested again in a second email, no, I just want the particular policy. You don't have to wade through an entire manual. He immediately wrote back, there's an index, and it's true there is. I've not yet been able to use it successfully, but could be I'm either lazy, too quick, or just the index is defective, or I'm not using the right tactic. Andy's still refusing requests for a Free Radio Santa Cruz interview, as well as answers to numerous other questions I put to him back in December. Actually, I didn't really put the questions to him. I put out a flyer about the police department generally, and he sent me a long response to each question, which was pretty vague, and I asked for more details, and I never got them, in spite of repeated requests. So that's the update. There was actually a meeting yesterday. The Downtown Association sponsored two meetings of the police department on so-called public safety and mental health, which I didn't get to, but I may have some details on that in a future broadcast if I actually get a chance to talk to someone who made it there. Back now to Brent Adams and the interview that I found quite interesting.
Let's get back to the issue which I've been pressing you on, which is, you still intending to open up in early June?
Yeah, well, as I told you, we're going to have a meeting on the 30th again for me to talk about all of the meetings I've had. I've had a street-side conversation with Martin Bernal now, had a meeting with a few other people, notables, have some people working behind the scenes. It has not gone very well. It's weird. People have actually shared their emails with me that they've had with the city. Tentatively, we're going to go ahead. Just need to have everything ready, and we might do something that I feel that I don't want to do with this nonprofit in a project this important and potentially costly. Is do it in a renegade style. I don't believe it should be done in a renegade style. It should be welcomed by the community at large and the city and the county. It's frustrating that it seems either not valued or challenging in this way, that it might be.
You know, I'd appreciate it, Brent, if you would say city government, because to tar
the city
population with the city government label, they aren't the city. They're the city government. And I don't think you're being renegades at all. I think you're being you're a volunteer organization that's meeting needs that other groups are not. And you might wish you could do it better and hope you could get some help from here and there and, you know, hope against hope the city would finally abandon its gentrification insanity, which they aren't. You know, but they don't. And then because they don't, you proceed to do what you need to do if you're going to do it. But it's not a renegade. You're not breaking any windows here.
No, it's only a renegade if we decide to do the street meter method.
Which means what?
Food dot bombs type, finding a location at a street meter or in a parking lot, parking garage, and trying to be there every day, two times a day, just by paying like any other car or truck does, and yet running a program out of it.
I'm not sure that's even, if it's not illegal, although they might try to make it illegal, I don't think, I mean, in parking lots, provided you keep running your vehicle in and out every 15 minutes, you're still legal.
Yeah.
All right.
So we're going to try to do it. I mean, I've got some plans. I've got about a list of 20 locations where this could happen at the very lowest level. I'm just saying budgetarily, we're starting to get some funding. We could lease a space, rent a space, find a more legit space for the truck to be. We'll see. But to start, we're starting small, and we want to see how the program behaves before we really invest in it. But it would be great to, when I say the city, it is a city, it's a corporation, and they're going to be here forever. They're going to outlast us all. And they are profiting from the new gentrification that we're seeing. They don't really care. They like it. Anything that brings in more money, especially we're starting to see that as people can't afford Santa Cruz, and a lot of people are going to be, they say they're going to be selling their spaces, whatever. It's just the game exists, and I get it. I think that it makes it more difficult for us because things are getting so much more expensive, and
true enough. But I mean, the another issue for me is the Food Not Bombs is only renegade, for example, in the sense that it had to fight back. It began as an organization fighting militarism years ago, and it did this also, and then it turned into being concerned about homeless people being fed and learning to feed themselves, and joining up in similar groups with Homes Not Jails and occupying buildings, things that city governments and state governments and corporations refused to do and don't give a shit about. But the community does give a shit about it. And there is still a moral core in the community which supported Food Not Bombs and supports it here, in that regard, I think. I mean, I've got criticism of Food Not Bombs, too, which I haven't gone into recently, but I probably will at some point. But I think also, some of the reason that they're not bothered is the city knows they would have a tough fight on their hands if the city government knows. They would have a tough fight on their hands if they proceeded. And the question to me, I guess I have for you, is do you think your group has the same kind of resilience, or would they fade away in the night out of fear of being illegal? That's the question.
Well, so when you say they would have a tough fight on their hands, the people who support, my critique of Food Not Bombs is great. It's when they talk about what they're really about, they're about, systems change at the governmental level, so that it's, and they're serving food, but they don't really make themselves too responsible for the, nutrition or dietary intake of people. But they're doing it at the same time. They're serving a lot of food to a lot of people. And I think people see value in that. When we talk about community, of course, we have to acknowledge that there's 1, 2, 3, maybe 5 different versions of the community. And so noting that, one part of the community would get really irate and they would show up and demonstrate, and it would not be easy for the city to stop Food Not Bombs. It could go national, like we've seen. And I think Keith McHenry, being the head of it, is perfectly poised to be spring-loaded. If they ever tried to stop Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs, the thing would be enormous. It would go national, and you'd have thousands of people pouring into Santa Cruz from the local area, from San Francisco to, wherever, defending Food Not Bombs' right. I think the city totally knows that, and it's not a fight that they give a shit about.
The city government, you mean?
City government. With the Warming Center nonprofit running a storage program, much different. It does not require volunteers. It'll have 1 or 2 paid employees operating it. It's really meant to meet basic needs. It's not, while it does address systems change, and it is anarchistic at its design level unintentionally, which means, we just do what we need to do for the community, and we find ways to do it and fund it. That's very sort of a DIY aesthetic, and it's, but it's not building community in the operation of it day to day. So it would be easy to take it down, And my support network is not, we're not building a support network to be resilient in the face of that, which is why the thing is vulnerable. So when I build things, it's all the design of the concept. That's why everything is called a program. It's not Food Not Bombs program. It's Food Not Bombs. You know, it's very basic. But we, you know, we always have these, you know, papers with staples and lots of words. It's all very verbiage, and it's a program that we geek out on, the protocols, the rules, how it should or should not be done. It can't deviate from those words because it's all about structure and the way the management is supposed to behave of this thing.
And yet you know, Brent, and I think that what really activates this is your daily, weekly, your years long experience and feeling in response to the fact that people are getting fucked over because they have to carry their stuff around all day, that they get stolen from, you know, all that stuff that you and I know full well and that listeners know full well. And that's really what animates us, just as what Food Not Bombs was animated by. Well, when they hit San Francisco, originally they were legal. They didn't, I think they didn't even get permits back in Massachusetts and Cambridge because it wasn't demanded of them. I'm not sure of that. But I know when they came to San Francisco, they were not a national group. They didn't have a big, you know, Keith McHenry, big guy, could call everybody from all over the world.
Yeah.
They got attacked massively, and the Santa Cruz community responded, and Mayor Agnos, who was the mayor then in 88, had to stop. Because it was clear every time they arrested, they prompted more people. Now, times have changed since 1988, there's no question. But, you know, to some extent, you know, the same kind of issue maybe is around with things like needle exchange, safe site injection centers, things of this sort that start illegally. They start because they're needed. And, you know, and indeed, it's good to have programs designed if you can ever get these, you know, essentially nervous, cowardly bureaucrats in charge to start doing it, or politicians to pay less attention to the right-wing fanatics and more attention to their, you know, their liberal postures. But, you know, the fact that you're doing it is the issue. And I guess what I want to know for, you know, maybe because listeners have not said to me, is Brent opening it? They haven't said that to me. But I think that some of them are wondering that, you know, are you going to open it if they try to shut you down? And you might say, well, you know, I don't know until I meet with May 30th or May, we meet in May with my folks, you know. But you also may have a sense of, you have said in the past that, you know, you think you're going to proceed. You're hoping that the city will act reasonably because it's a reasonable proposal. And you're trying to accommodate all these sections of the community. But your main focus is not in accommodating all the sections of the community, but in serving the needs of the people who really need it. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I think that, well, so there's two things there. One is definitely it's needs-based, and definitely I am driven to make this happen one way or another. Since we're getting support from funders, almost everybody agrees. I'm getting some flack from the people who still think this is type, you know, a type of magnet. You know, like if we do nice things for people who sleep outside, we'll just draw more here. But I think most people get immediately on the face of it that this is going to reduce a lot of the hardship of homelessness. It's going to improve our experience of homelessness. All of us, including people who sleep outside. Everybody gets it. The city is very busy with their 3-phase plan. They're massively invested. They didn't want me involved in it. They did not want us at the table. They kicked us out of a funding scheme. So the question is, building community around it that could be resilient is what we're doing. But what we want to do is build community around a larger concept of needs-based programs and support of our nonprofit in the sense that, or any nonprofit, the coalition, we're trying to encourage an incubator, idea incubator, that so many people have ideas. Can we help them move them forward? Because it's really hard to have an idea and actually turn it into something that's working legitimately. And we've seen 1,000 ideas come down the pike. People don't actually ever do them. That's why we kind of roll our eyes when we hear somebody with an idea these days, because it just, you know, people just don't, they just never take it from that idea stage to, you know, fruition. So what we want to have is a design concept that says less, doing more with less. warming center literally does, you know, has 80 people, 100 through Santa Cruz and Watsonville on the worst nights of the year, sleeping in a shelter situation that normally would have way more city oversight, city government oversight than it does, but it's because they trust us. Everybody, nobody speaks negatively about the warming center now. There's no resistance movement. Everybody supports it, at least in so much as they don't protest it or anything. They don't talk shit about it. It's the Brent Adams thing. My point is, I want to build programs that are respected, that do the work it says it's going to do, that benefits the community, and does it efficiently, and it is not seen to be doing it, thumbing its nose at the city like Food Not Bombs has as kind of one of its intentions. They don't try to find a place, like the city was trying to find a place for Food Not Bombs to do it inside with, you know, better facilities. They said, fuck you. We want to do it on the sidewalk, where it's not really a good place to be serving food. They had a huge vermin problem, as you recall, this time last year. But devil may care. They just did it anyway. That's the brilliance of Food Not Bombs. We don't share that ethic, that operational. We don't want to make enemies. We're trying to show that when you use the word, the big C, community, that we are the big C community. We're doing this for all of us, not just for a few of us. We're not doing it in a brash way that says, fuck you, or try to stop us, we're going to do it. And we, you know.
I follow you, Brent. I think you're not answering my question, though.
I know. I'm saying what I want to say.
But. I mean, well, you know, I'm not criticizing you. I'm just saying, the answer that I'm looking for is, you know, has your group got the will to proceed anyway, and it sounds like that your will is.
They defunded us. They kicked us out of the room. They shamed us publicly.
Are you going to be opening in June? Is really the question, regardless of what they do.
We've already come back. They already squashed the storage program.
Well, is that a yes? In other words.
Oh yeah, this program is going to be happening one way or another.
Okay, I mean that's what I'm wondering. And when will people know about it? Probably by June 1st, they'll know.
They can call the number 234-9848 beginning June 1st. We expect to have a soft launch. If my advocacy group, what do you call that? That's a ad hoc advocacy group. You know, votes definitely that we should not do it. But when we have some of the, you know, former mayor, other people have been giving us a lot of counsel to go for it. And so that's really going to help weigh in. What I have to do again is, you know, get the organizing, computer device to make sure the hardest part of this is if we have 100 people using the program, I've got half of their stuff in a regular storage and half of their stuff on board the transportable device, and things, people are coming and going. I have to really make sure that the situation is run effectively so that nobody ever has a mix-up with their stuff and everything is safe and well-organized.
It sounds like it's uncertain, then, that you are going to start in June. I mean, that's what I'm hearing from you.
No, we're going to start – we have a soft launch planned for June 1st.
Okay, I remember the soft launch plan for May 1st, too, you know.
Barring a decision on June 30th – I'm sorry, May 30th.
Right.
Yeah, I can say anything effectively, you know, more effectively after the 30th. I've promised to wait for the 30th meeting before we make any full statement.
Okay.
And it's going to run under, it's going to be a soft launch. We're not going to be making any real statements about it until July.
Right. So, but it sounds like that, you know, you could decide not to do it on May 30th if your board says don't do it. And so it's not a sure go at the moment. That's, I mean, I want to be honest about that. So,
it's pretty much a go.
Okay. So I want to thank you and give you a chance to sum up anything you want to add and encourage you to remember again. The city government is not the city. You know that anyway, but it's easy, I think, to fall into that trap. M.H. Can, I think, fell into that trap. I was talking to Sarah Leonard about this yesterday. She was there at the, as you probably know, at the Project Homeless Connect. Anyway, but, you know, you have the last word.
So. I think while I hear you, I'm learning that the city government is the city, that they own it. The county owns the county. It's a police state. I got to be careful with my words. They do have the jails. It's a de facto police state that we live in. They run the show. You don't get to do what you want to do. MHCAN learned that they'll make you reorganize your entire fucking program just to get a bit of money. And MHCAN had to do that. The city, when we talk about the community, there are many different communities. It's important to realize that the city is a corporation, and they don't really have a social services, human services wing. It's all about the materials of providing, water and waste and garbage. I'll pick up all that stuff. The city does really well. What I have to learn is that the city, the other city we're talking about, is the people within the city, the community, as we call it, so many different types of people. Santa Cruz is a very intelligent town, becoming increasingly wealthy, and a lot of the people we knew and loved don't live here anymore. And so to appeal to that community, that city, we have to do really good work, be really clear about what our values are. And so that's what we're about. It's not, and this work is not about Brent Adams. I am the person who did a lot of research, and I have a strong vision. But a lot of this stuff is needs based. We all share these desires and this collective pain. And I am a leader in this movement and trying to open up the space where we all can share, which is, let's alleviate some of the pain on the street.
And again, for more information, people can call.
Thank you. So it's warmingcenterprogram.com. Facebook page, the same thing, Warming Center Program. Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz is a Facebook page I like people to look at. But the hotline is 831-234-9848. Thanks. You really got me talking. I got to talk to my board now.
Just don't beat your chest too hard, okay?
All right.
Thanks, Brent.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And there's going to be some more stuff on Sunday coming up on the 9:30 to 3 long edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides, an interview with MHCAN activists, including Sarah Leonard at the Project Homeless Connect, as well as an interview with Salinas activist Wes White. Instead of the Wes White interview, I'm slipping in here an interesting podcast. You'll now be hearing a podcast from the On San Francisco series by the San Francisco Gate. It's a chronicle, I guess, that does this. Heather Knight hosts a podcast interviewing San Francisco's Dr. Philip Coffin on the opioid epidemic there. Really interesting podcast I ran across, which I want to pass on to you now, even though it's usually something I don't play because you can find it. In fact, you probably will find it if you don't catch all of it here on the website of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to On San Francisco, the San Francisco Chronicle's podcast on the people and politics making headlines in the city by the bay. I'm columnist Heather Knight, and I'm joined by Dr. Philip Coffin, Director of Substance Use Research at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. San Franciscans have a lot of questions about the city's injection drug use epidemic, and Dr. Coffin has the answers. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure.
First, I wanted to ask a question that I think a lot of San Franciscans have, which is that when we walk around the city, we see so much injection drug use happening in the broad daylight in public on city streets. Why has this epidemic taken a hold so strongly in San Francisco and throughout the country? Can you kind of explain the backstory on why we're seeing this?
Sure. So there's kind of two things going on, I guess. San Francisco's been a place where there's a fair amount of substance use for a long time. That's been part of the nature of the city, and the city's always been very welcoming to anyone in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that sometimes we have a fair number of people who sometimes aren't wanted in other places, and we're a welcoming city. So that's sort of part of the San Francisco element. It's nationwide, it's kind of a more complex story. There's kind of two crises that happened. The first was the prescription opiate crisis or epidemic, and that was that really started in the late 1990s. And actually, some investigators at Yale picked up on it in New England as early as around 1998, 97, 98, and that was with OxyContin. And it was picked up on nationally in 2007 by the CDC when they started recognizing that there was a escalating, skyrocketing prescription opioid overdose mortality. Mm. And then the interventions to start trying to address it began probably around 2010, which has led to a pretty substantial reduction in opioid prescribing. But by that point, we had such a demand for opioids by the number of people that now had opioid use disorders that there wasn't enough opium poppy in the world to fulfill the American diet.
Wow.
So fentanyl emerged, and fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that you can make in a bathtub, and it's way more potent than heroin or any of the other prescription opioids, and so it's easier to produce and easier to move to where it needs to be. However, it is so potent that it's hard to titrate. It's hard to determine how much you need in a use episode. So, and it's hard to sort of cut it in proper amounts without doing it in a controlled laboratory facility.
Uh-huh.
So you end up with opiates on the street that are radically different, radically varying potencies and overdose rates that are way higher because fentanyl having come on the market and replaced a lot.
What is the effect of fentanyl on the body? Like, what is it like to take that drug?
So if you think about sort of street opiates that people traditionally buy, so we'll ignore the prescription opioids and think about heroin. So there's two kinds of heroin that are two main kinds of heroin. There's black tar heroin, which is what we see west of the Mississippi and south of the Canadian border.
Okay.
And there's powder heroin, which is what you'll see east of the Mississippi and north of the Canadian border. Literally between Seattle and Vancouver, you go from tar to powder, never the twain shall meet.
Why is that?
It's gangs. It's the drug trade control. The border patrol isn't that good. There's a lot of differences between tar and powder. One being the name and what it's going to look like. The tar is kind of blackish, brownish, and the powder is a whitish powder. The next difference is the effect. So the tar heroin has a whole bunch of different opioids in it. It's not just heroin. It's got morphine and codeine and lots of other opioid alkaloids that makes it kind of a more holistic experience in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like smoking opium as opposed to using just the morphine or heroin component of the opium.
Mm-hmm.
So people who use tar feel a more sort of holistic, full body experience. And then if they go to use the powder heroin, to them it feels very sharp.
Hmm.
And then if you go use fentanyl, that's another big step further. It's a much sharper, more intense high. It's very lipophilic, so it passes really quickly into the brain through the blood-brain barrier. So when you use fentanyl, the effect is even faster than heroin.
And how long does that last?
That initial rush. It's going to last sort of an hour-ish.
Uh-huh.
So a much shorter high. So it's more intense high, more edgy, and shorter.
And it's more addictive, right? How many times do you have to take that to become addicted?
So there's... I can't give a number of times anyone has to take anything to get addicted, but fentanyl certainly is difficult to use in a manner that doesn't lead to some elements of a use disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from its use in pain management and in clinical context, it is.
Does it have an appropriate use in that?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, we use fentanyl particularly in cancer pain, metastatic cancer pain, end-of-life pain, things like that. Fentanyl is a critical and really important and really valuable medication. Also, in clinical settings, if you've ever had a surgical procedure, you've almost certainly been administered fentanyl.
Hmm.
It's the go-to opioid for surgical procedures because it's so quick on and so quick off. Anesthesiologists love it. It is also the drug that an anesthesiologist is most likely to develop a disorder with themselves because they have easy access to it.
Oh, wow.
So in the medical profession, anesthesiologists are those most likely to develop an opioid use disorder, and it's most likely going to be with fentanyl.
Interesting.
Another difference between the tar and the powder that's kind of, I think, really fascinating is the tar heroin. We never quite had the HIV epidemic in the areas with tar heroin as we did in areas with powder heroin.
Hmm.
Now, part of this, of course, we had good syringe access, but added on top of that was that tar heroin doesn't seem to transmit. The use of tar heroin doesn't seem to transmit HIV as readily as the use of powder heroin, and that is for a couple of reasons. One, the tar sclerosis the veins, so you lose your veins really quickly, and when you're intramuscular injecting, it's not as efficient a route of transmitting HIV. And another is that tar gums up syringes, so you have to rinse out your syringe before using it again, so you don't have as much residue and blood left. So although we did have HIV crises from injection in tar areas, it was never to the extent as we saw in powder areas.
Hmm. And you said this is a tar area,
yeah,
right?
This is a tar area. Yeah.
Huh. And why do people inject so openly in San Francisco? You talked a little bit about the welcoming attitude. I've heard that they want to be in public in case they overdose and they can get help, but I'm not sure if that's accurate. I've also heard that the places they could do it hidden before, like squatting and warehouses, don't really exist anymore because there's so much development. I wonder if any of those are accurate.
Yeah, so this is hard for me to speak to the science because I can't claim there's science behind it.
Okay.
But in terms of my perception, I think the largest driver is the building in the city and the lack of squats and the lack of empty lots. There's always been a lot of drug injection going on in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's really hard to find a place to do it where you're not being seen by other people.
Yeah.
We do believe that there was an increase in the number of people who inject drugs in San Francisco between 2005 and 2012.
Uh-huh.
Since that time, it doesn't seem like we've seen much of an increase, and it's really since that time, since 2012, I think, when the visibility has increased
right.
so much.
Yeah.
So the increase over the last 5 years seems like it appears to be mostly visibility as opposed to sheer numbers,
mm-hmm.
in terms of numbers of people who are injecting drugs.
And what does the science say about how to get this off of our sidewalks? I don't know if there is a scientific element to that, but what would you
sure.
say City Hall should be doing? Because, I mean, I hear from frustrated residents with children who don't want to be walking over dirty needles and seeing this so blatantly.
We do a lot of the things that are best practices around managing substance use disorders. It's largely opioids, but it's also a lot of methamphetamine and a fair amount of cocaine as well. The ways I think about it are sort of different levels of prevention, sort of the primary prevention of people not initiating substance use or not developing these disorders, and then thinking about ways to minimize the complications of substance use disorders, and then ways to treat substance use disorders towards reduced use or discontinued use.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mix of there, you raise the public injection piece and discarded syringes. On that front specifically, the things that we do, we have a pretty aggressive efforts at managing discarded syringes in terms of Department of Public Works and Department of Public Health, doing surveys, doing counts and picking up discarded syringes. And then the other thing is having Sharps containers. So we now have, I believe, 19 Sharps containers around the city that are designated places like mailbox type facilities,
the big ones, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for where people can discard their syringes. And we've talked about, or we will talk about, the safer injection services that we're working on, and that is another element. No one element like this is going to get syringes or drug use completely off the street.
Mm-hmm.
the hope is that combining all of these elements together can take more of it out of the public eye.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of safe injection sites, there's none currently in the U.S., although San Francisco's on track to probably become the first city to open one, I think, this summer. Can you talk about the science behind them and why so many other countries have found that they work?
I think Rotterdam likes to claim credit for that in the basement of a church.
Huh.
The first one that was legally sanctioned is Bern, Switzerland. And it was really Bern, and then Switzerland, and then it was Germany.
How many years ago was that?
1986 would have been Bern. So early 80s, this started.
So we're pretty far behind the curve, which is unusual for San Francisco.
Well, we are part of the United States.
Yeah.
So on interventions and ways to, you know, manage substance use and reduce the consequences of drug use, the U.S. has not been a leader on very many topics. There's a few where it has, like naloxone for overdose mm-hmm. prevention, it has, but in many others, it hasn't been a leader. So the facilities pretty quickly grew as a way of managing both public drug use
mm-hmm.
And risk for disease transmission and risk for overdose and ways to be able to reach people who otherwise were disconnected from the system and didn't trust traditional medical care model type systems.
Mm-hmm.
The facility in Vancouver, Insight, which is probably the most well-known injection service, opened in 2001, I believe, and that's also the most heavily researched site.
Mm-hmm. Have you been there?
Yeah, I have. And actually, just this week, I was in another site in Edmonton, Canada, in Alberta, that is in a hospital. It's actually an inpatient injection service in a hospital, which I had never seen or heard about before, and it was fascinating to think about as a way to help people, for example, who are going to be in medical care for a long time, but in San Francisco might be leaving against medical advice and going out on the streets and getting sicker and sicker and sicker. So a service like this helps them to stay in the hospital. A fascinating model, which I can't foresee in the United States anytime soon.
Yeah.
But a really interesting construct. And then Insight came along. And now, actually, in 2012, the Canadian Supreme Court looked at the supervised injection service there and determined that not only was it legal, but other cities were required to consider developing them.
Oh, wow.
Because it had been proven so beneficial.
What is so beneficial about them for skeptical Franciscans?
So I guess I can tell you a little bit of what a service like this looks like.
Yeah.
So some of them are standalone, where it's just an injection service alone. Other ones are integrated into other care systems. So you might have it next to a clinic where somebody can get wound care or primary medical care. Might be integrated with vaccination services. Might be integrated with a methadone service. Or buprenorphine or naltrexone or other forms of substance use disorder treatment services. So you can imagine it in any level from solely an injection service model to a fully integrated one-stop shopping type approach. And generally there are sort of three parts to such a service. One is where you enter and you get triaged, and you check in, you sign in, you register, you answer a few questions. For example, the service is going to want to know what type of drug that you're likely to be using.
Mm-hmm.
And then is the injection service itself. And inside there's generally, on average, I think most places have about 7 stations where people can inject, and a station is kind of a little cubicle with a mirror and a chair and a table.
Why is there a mirror?
So the mirror is there both because it can help the person who's injecting to find the right spot, but also so that the people who are supervising the service can see if everything is going okay.
Hmm.
For example, some people lose access to veins in their arms, and they may have to inject into their neck. and injecting into your neck can be dangerous, particularly if you do it wrong. If somebody was injecting, let's say, the wrong direction, the person supervising it, you know, is looking around and can see if they're sticking it in the wrong direction or if they're going somewhere that looks like they're going to hit an artery or something like that.
Wow.
So they can help to guide the person to inject safely.
I pictured it like just being an open room, but people are kind of in their own little slots.
Yeah, generally it's people in their own little slots. Hmm. Exactly. And then there's a third room, which is a chill-out room, where people can go after they use to chill out and relax. And that's the room usually where there might be some food there, there might be somebody, you know, engaged in a research study, or there might be somebody offering services, you know, or a social worker might be there, or an addiction counselor might be there. Somebody might be there to offer things to people who come to that site. And one of the things that it's led to is really a much increased enrollment in substance use disorder treatment services and in referrals in connection to medical care. Because a lot of people who inject drugs have a lot of bad experiences with the healthcare system,
mm-hmm.
and a really hard time trusting traditional models of healthcare. So much like syringe access services, needle exchange programs, are a place where people who don't trust the system are able to connect and get referrals, and a lot of people get connected to the system through a needle exchange program. It's where most people would go if they wanted to look into getting treatment for mm-hmm. a substance use disorder that started a needle exchange program, because it's people that they trust. Likewise, a safe injection service is even more in that direction in terms of being able to capture the hardest to reach population and link them to services that we have. So that's one thing that injection services have done, and I think that's really substantial. They've been shown to reduce hepatitis C and HIV transmission. It gets people more interested in adjusting drug use behaviors and learning about safer drug use and safer injection, because when somebody injects drugs, you know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong,
mm-hmm.
In terms of where they inject, how they inject, the damage that can be done to their body, and so preventing that kind of damage can be really important. I've taken care of a lot of people who are, for example, a 20-year-old woman who injected drugs for just a few months, but she was doing it wrong, and she gets septic femoral thrombophlebitis, where she gets an infected clot in the vein in her leg, and that clot is probably never going to really open up. So even if she stops drugs after injecting for a few months when she's in college, she's going to have a swollen leg that she contends with for the rest of her life. She's
wow.
going to have issues with that leg. And I think it's really a shame that somebody, you know, who experiments with something in their youth has to suffer a consequence like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, 20, 30 years down the road.
Yeah.
So
that would be a good PSA.
Yeah. So this kind of service can help in things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is it has definitely shown an ability to reduce overdose mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the probably my favorite study is the Vancouver study, where in the vicinity of the injection facility in the downtown Eastside neighborhood, they had a 37% reduction in overdose mortality after they opened the okay. injection service.
Do you know offhand how many people overdose in San Francisco?
Yeah, we have a total of about 200 overdose deaths a year from opioids, methamphetamine, and cocaine combined.
Wow.
About half are opioid. And yep. the other half are a combination of methamphetamine and cocaine.
And it seems like a benefit could possibly be getting some of these needles off the streets if people are doing it inside.
Yeah, so that it has also injection services have also been associated with reduced discarded needles
uh-huh.
in the neighborhoods where they're opened, and reduced public injection.
And San Francisco used to require a one-for-one needle exchange where you had to bring the dirty needle back to get a clean one, but ended that a few years ago, and now you can pretty much get however many needles you want. Can you talk about, that seems really counterintuitive to most people who aren't familiar with
sure.
this issue. Can you talk about why that?
So there's concern. So one of the ways that we plan for public health work is we do mathematical modeling where we look at what would happen if you have, if you did one thing. And when you look at mathematical models of syringe access, if you limit it to one for one, you actually end up with more infected syringes in the community
And when you have more infected syringes in the community, the risk of somebody actually accessing, whether it's through an accidental needle stick or it's through substance use, the risk of somebody accessing an infected needle actually goes up. Hmm. So one-for-one exchange
can
actually be associated with increased transmission of disease rather than decreased transmission of disease. That's the biggest concern. The recommendation in disease prevention communities is the goal is to try to get a clean needle every time you inject.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't approach that in San Francisco. We don't probably get a clean needle for, I don't know what the numbers are now, but I'm going to guess every five times somebody injects. We don't get anywhere near 100%. I don't think anyone does. And that's partly for convenience. People who are injecting drugs, you know, it's inconvenient to carry that many needles and syringes around with them.
Anything else you can tell me that people might be interested to know about this topic?
I do want to put in a plug for thinking about a substance use disorder like we think about type 2 diabetes.
Mm.
Imagine type 2 diabetes. So my dad had type 2 diabetes, and he didn't control it that well. My mom would routinely get in his car and find a half a dozen donuts under his chair that he hid from her and snuck, uh-huh. and his A1C would be 12, and his glucose would be out of control, and he suffered consequences from it. And, you know, it was frustrating. It was hard, and it was hard to see my dad, you know, hurt himself like that. But he saw a doctor who gave him aspirin, who gave him a statin, who checked his eyes and checked his feet, you know, and at least delayed the eventual amputation that he had.
Wow.
And checked his kidneys and did all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And type 2 diabetes is genetically predicted, so it's your genes, who your parents are, what mm-hmm. diseases they had. And it's also by lifestyle, so how active you are, how you manage your weight. Those things are all together predict type 2 diabetes. And if you think about what predicts an opioid use disorder, it's genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's lifestyle and what you're exposed to and how you live. So it's a combination of factors. Both of these are chronic diseases. Neither has a cure that you can take and it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this opioid crisis that we have in the country, we're not going to solve it, and there's not going to be any opioid use disorders in the country anymore. These are lifetime diseases that we manage.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're lucky and we do a really good job, people stay alive a long time, and we have a lot more people using opioids in the country because they stay alive longer. Just like with the HIV epidemic, as mm-hmm. we got better and better at managing it, we had more and more people with HIV because they
right.
lived.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way we manage it, there are treatments we have for opioid use disorder, and there are treatments we have for type 2 diabetes. And some people don't do well on those treatments. Some people don't accept them, or the treatments aren't good. Just don't work well with them. But we don't abandon them.
Mm-hmm.
We still do everything we can to take care of them. We check their kidneys, we check their feet, we check their eyes, we check their heart, we give them other medications in diabetes and in opioid use disorder, substance use disorders. We give them needles and syringes, we give them naloxone to prevent overdose, we give them vaccinations for pneumonia and tetanus and diphtheria and pertussis and influenza, and we screen them for sexually transmitted infections and HIV and hepatitis C, and we can treat their hepatitis C. If they're a stimulant user, we know that's a cardiac risk factor, so we can aggressively treat their blood pressure and their cholesterol and get them off cigarettes if we can't get them off cocaine, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things we can do in the medical system and in the community to help to minimize the consequences of substance use disorders, mm-hmm. much like we work to minimize the consequences of type 2 diabetes.
Hmm.
You know, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, brought us a step closer to being able to do this because it changed the funding streams and brought some money into substance use management. So it brings us a step closer to dealing with addiction like we deal with other chronic diseases, which ultimately, frankly, is where we need to be.
Mm-hmm.
But getting there is a long process.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we're a chunk on the way there,
mm-hmm.
but we have to keep working at it, and frankly, we have to keep being innovative to get there.
Right. Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
My friends, thank you for tuning in to FRSC, the finest radio in Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, our unassigned carrier frequency, and that, of course, means that we are pirate radio. Pirate radio made for you and me, for all those folks that just need to be heard, need a little voice and a moment on the airwaves. Come on down and join us. We'd love to see you. Freakradio.org is perhaps the easiest contacting resource. It has a phone number, email address, and a post office box. And that is because you have an antenna site for us. We're not broadcasting, and that's a little wacky for a pirate radio station not to be broadcasting. We're online, and we're grateful that you're there listening to us. But if you have a little site, about 3x3x3, that we could put a little bit of equipment into, that's about 150 watts of power it draws. That's like a bright light bulb. It also needs some internet, a little internetting possibility for some streaming of our source signal, and a tree into which to put a big copper antenna. Doesn't take up much space, again, very invisible, blends right in, and it's copper. Who doesn't want copper in their remodeling of their house? Thank you for contacting us with that information, frsc@freakradio.org. P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. I'm the host of the Yard Duck Show, stepping in here for just a moment to cover the cream to the dregs on this here Thanksgiving evening. A live program happening, and let's keep it live. That was Henry Kaiser we heard. Before that, the United States of America.